This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Emma Jane Unsworth on her Gerwood Fiction Uncovered prize-winning novel, Animals. Alex Horston on her debut novel, In My House. And some bonus Naomi Alderman. Emma Jane Unsworth is a journalist and won the Betty Trask Award for her novel Hungry, The Stars and Everything, and was shortlisted for the 2012 Portico Prize. Her short story I Arrive First was included in the Best British Short Stories 2012. Her latest book, which we're going to be talking about today, is Animals. So, Emma, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks for having me.
Should I say Emma or should I say Emma Jane?
Emma's fine. I'll tell you why I have the Jane there. It's because otherwise Emma and Unsworth run into each other and it's Emma Unsworth, which sounds like a Victorian school.
That's very northern, that does.
Very northern. Perfect. And also someone who might clean out chamber pots. Mm. So I thought I'd put the Jane in there to give it a bit of a break and make it sound, you know, slightly more impressive.
Tell us what this book's about. What's the story?
It's about two friends who live in Manchester and have been going out together, painting the town red for 10 years. And one of them has just got engaged to a man who's teetotal. So not only is there... Well, she's going to have to move out. So their whole kind of like life is going to change. Their whole living arrangement is going to change. But also the fact that he's teetotal, and because she and her friend are hellraisers, that means that their whole... you know, everything is kind of threatened and the whole friendship is threatened, really. And everything is going to change. But what happens over the course of the book is that... you realise that maybe the narrator secretly wants things too, because this friendship has run its course and she's actually a bit bored.
But there is that tension all the way through, isn't there? Because at the same time, she is having doubts.
Yeah, she's got doubts about everything. She's completely anxious and neurotic and paranoid, partly to do with her lifestyle and the hangovers that come with it, but also because she's just reached that point, I think, that a lot of women reach in their early 30s, where the pressures are on them to settle down, to calm down. Maybe you should stop going out so much. Maybe you should stop drinking so much. Maybe you should stop taking drugs. Maybe you should stop smoking. Maybe you should think about having a baby and get married. And so all of that was something I wanted to explore and explode, if I possibly could.
Well, there's two points to that, isn't there? Because there's also just an idea that there's something wrong with women misbehaving in the first place.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that there's a great judgment put upon women, the older that they get, especially when they do continue to go out and be party. There's something a bit tragic about women who are in their 50s who are still partying, and I really disagree with that. And I think it's a judgment that's put on women that isn't put on men in the same way. And it's partly biological. It is partly because if you do want to have a family, then as a woman, the baby is probably going to grow in your family if you're going to do it that way. So you are going to have to, you know, curb all those things at least. But, you know, I think it runs throughout women's lives as well. And there's a media story that I do write about in the book, that when I worked as a journalist in Manchester, so came to my attention and angered me. It was when all the Take That concerts were on, when they'd regrouped. And the way that the female fans and the fun that they had going to those concerts, because the women were in their 30s now rather than the teenagers that they were when Take That were first together, the way that it was reported was so offensive, the way it demonised the women. It was all like, look at the state of them in the pink Stetsons going out. Shouldn't they be at home? That was all the implication. Yeah. Being sick in people's gardens and clogging up A&E. And it was all this terribly sexist, horrible stuff that made these women just seem like idiots or tragedies or just doing something wrong. And it really, really enraged me, because I looked into it, looked into the figures, and actually there were no more people admitted to casualty on those nights than there were during football matches, which would be traditionally more male-gendered, you know, events to go to, or Peter Kay concerts, for example, things like that. But because it was women doing it, you know, they were instantly demonised and instantly... Because I think society is scared of women continuing to go wild and enjoy themselves. And that's something that that I really want to fight.
And not just women, but who those women are as well.
Yeah, every year, what's their purpose?
Every year I furiously tweet something about the inevitable story in the Daily Mail about all the women pissed out of their minds at Aintree the day before the Grand National.
We can't control them, isn't it terrible?
Look at the state of these women. How dare they have a good time?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, if someone's been violent and horrible, but most of the women I know are wonderful, jolly, garrulous drunks. So why the hell can't they just keep doing what they want to do?
So tell us about Laura, who's the narrator, and Tyler, the two friends. Tell us something about their characters. Okay. Who are they?
So Laura is, well, she hates her job. She works in a call centre. She's 32. She wants to be a writer and has been trying for many years to be a writer. Never had much success and also doesn't quite knuckle down to actually do it.
Her novel sounds great, though.
Thanks. Yeah, there's Bacon about a priest who falls in love with a talking pig. I'm slightly taking the mickey out of myself and my previous book there, which was about, which had some magic realism in it. So, yeah, so she, but she wants escape. That's what she wants. She wants freedom and escape. And she's feeling more and more penned in by her situation professionally, socially, and romantically, and physically as well as a woman. And so that's her. And then Tyler is a total punk and a total hellraiser and anarchist, really, in many ways as well, and really wants to shake things up wherever she goes and will always be the one who wants to drop the bomb conversationally, will always be the last man standing at a party. And she wants to maintain the status quo because she's very happy keeping on doing that. But actually, as I explored her character, it struck me that she actually was far more conservative than Laura, even though she would say that she's a liberal and strong anarchist, you know, and want to take that to the limits. Actually, I think sometimes people who would say, you know, this is what I'm doing and I'm going to keep doing it to the nth degree forever, that's actually quite a conservative viewpoint, and especially when you want to keep and contract your friend into doing that for the duration and won't give them room for manoeuvre. And that's it. Tyler won't give Laura any room for manoeuvre in her new relationship or in her desires for escape. So that actually becomes oppressive. As oppressive as the romantic relationship, so yeah, that's where they find themselves.
And although, I mean, we've just explained how we both believe it's a bad thing that women hedonists are seen as somehow it's worse for women to do that than men. But at the same time, I wanted to talk about why they're doing it in terms of what have they been. You know, what life were they sold? Do you know what I mean? How do you end up being a 30-something person? The world has changed so much, so, you know, they're 30-something people. She's has a dead-end job. All their horizons are basically going out and having a good time. It's almost a sort of reaction against the life that they were supposed to have led.
Yeah, but I also think because it's fun. I think they have a lot of fun when they go out together. And even though things have reached a point of staleness, I suppose, in terms of the friendship and in terms of Laura feeling hemmed in by Tyler's demands, actually they still do have a great deal of fun when they go out. And I guess, yeah, I mean, why do they do it? I think because in a way, when they go out and get wrecked, it's a holiday from worrying about what they're doing with their lives or what they're not doing with their lives. And that was a kind of comment I wanted to make. And also, I think it's very easy to get stuck in a cycle of that kind of lifestyle, cycle of going out, hangover, then worrying about what the hell you're doing with your life, but then actually just going out again rather than. So it's a state of denial, and I do accept that. It is a state of denial for both of them, I think, even though Laura would more readily acknowledge it. But also, I think it's the human condition, isn't it? Whatever way we choose to express that. I think we all feel like we live in cycles to some extent, and we do all go through the motions. And you do that and do it and do it and do it, and you reach a point, and actually then you think, that's enough, now I break. But until you reach that point, you do tend to live in circles. I do. And that's not just related to things like drink. That's just kind of like, that's just life. You just go through a cycle every day, every year, every 7 years, and then you break out of it if and when you need to.
And they do. I mean, in this book, they do the same thing pretty much in different venues, different towns, over and over and over again.
But there's something to explore within the boredom of that, I think.
Yeah,
and
exactly,
just to say, repetition and boredom aren't necessarily things to be avoided or ignored. I think there's lots to explore because there's nuance there, even in these nights out that do feel like they're full of the same catchphrases and full of the same. This, if you take that drug, you know you will end up in that place at midnight and in that place at 3 a.m. and in that place at 9 a.m. And even though there is that, there's something, because of the characters that they encounter, they do fling themselves in different situations socially. They do really go to the parameters of Manchester, which is, you know, a brilliant city, but quite a small city in many ways as well. So they do sort of, they find enough new stuff to keep them going, and they have done for 10 years, certainly.
We'll come back to Manchester, but Jim, tell us about Jim.
Jim is Laura's fiancé. Even though they both hate that word. And he is a classical pianist who has recently become teetotal. Because that's actually something I've heard happens, because I don't know any classical pianists personally, but I know friends who've worked with them, and they've said, you know, quite often they go teetotal because you literally can't handle a hangover or being drunk on the job. You know, you've really got to, it's so precise and fans are so ferociously attentive that you've really got to get everything right, and the pressure's on, and if your career's taking off, which his career has just started to take off, then, you know, he's just got to commit to that, and something's got to give, and what has to give for him is the booze. And so even though he and Laura met in a bar, and they've had wonderful times drunk together, he's decided to let that part of his life go to focus on his work. And it's just whether his and Laura's relationship can survive that decision, I suppose, given her tastes.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Emma Jane Unsworth, and we're talking about her novel Animals. And yeah, just before we broke, you mentioned Manchester, Emma, and I was wondering how different this book would have been if it was set in London. There's something I've only very recently, the last couple of years, become familiar with Manchester and have really fallen in love with it. It is a great town, but very different from London, and the nightlife's different. And I wonder, have you thought how different it would have been if it was set somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can't imagine it being set anywhere else. For me, it couldn't have been set anywhere else for two reasons. Firstly, because I knew Manchester inside out, and that's where I was writing this book from. Secondly, I don't think any other city would have put up with these girls, actually. Manchester is a radical city and has a wonderful radical history, and I adore it for that. And it kind of, it endures the sort of these women. It tolerates them and celebrates them almost. They always find good company when they go out, because that's the kind of place Manchester is. And I don't think you can get away with that kind of stuff in certainly no other cities that I've experienced so far in my life. But also, Manchester is a city that's in flux, and it was when I was working there a couple of years ago writing this book. It's a place of great change, and so it was. I guess when people talk about place and setting being a character in a book, the way that Manchester works in that way is that it extended the things I was exploring in the characters, in Laura's yearning for change and to shake things up. And kind of Manchester is a place where, since 96, the cityscape has completely, since the bomb in 96, the cityscape has completely changed, and various other reasons as well. So it suited it for that. The setting was right, because it was just like, it was an extended metaphor in that way, but also in the city, yeah, was very characterful in terms of me furthering what I was exploring through the two girls.
And it struck me as well, it's also, I mean, the city has changed beyond recognition, but it still remains, fundamentally, as you said, a radical city and a working class city.
Yeah, definitely.
And we mentioned before we started Zoe Pilger's Eat My Heart Out. Zoe was on Little Atoms last year, and her city is based in London and in the art world and in the rich world. And it almost seems they're quite thematically similar in terms of a main female character who likes a drink, to cut it short, but the worlds in which they inhabit are very different.
Definitely. I mean, Zoe's book, which I love, is a satire, so it's different in that way. Mine has satirical points, but it isn't entirely a satire. So I think that the way that... And there is a scene that takes place in London in the book when they go to visit Tyler's sister and her new baby and sort of see that kind of different world. And we can't let Tyler entirely off the hook, because she isn't working class. Laura is, but Tyler isn't. And Tyler is a bit of a trust fund kid, really, even though she's been cut off from her family and cut herself off from her dad, who she had a terrible relationship with. But she's privileged in lots of ways as well. And she's got this flat that she can live in without having to work too hard. She's got, you know,
which
her dad has paid for, and all the complications that come with that. But she's you know, she doesn't have to worry about going out, really, and making that much of a living. In a way, Laura has more financial worries than Tyler does. But I wanted to use Tyler as a kind of slightly glamorous in a faded glamour way, you know, like those old sort of music halls where the paint's peeling, but you can still see the sort of, you know, the cornices and stuff. That's Tyler.
Well, there's room we're in now.
Slightly room we're in now, yeah, very, very apt. But yeah, that's Tyler for me. There's something kind of faded, kind of Hollywood glamour about her. So she's in a kimono, smoking a fag, but her makeup's all down her face and there's stains on her kimono. So she's sort of, yeah, there's something kind of like old rich about her, I suppose, in that way. And she is drawn to the sort of the underbelly of life. She's drawn to the dirt. She's drawn to hanging out in the grotto. sweatiest places that she possibly can. But she's not working class. Even though it makes sense to me that she's in Manchester, and it makes sense to me that Laura's attracted to Tyler as well for that side of her, mm-hmm. because of seeking escape and something a bit different to what Manchester has to offer in many ways, I suppose. The exotic nature of Tyler was something that I suppose makes it quite at odds with the working class model, of the city, such an old industrial city such as Manchester. You've got these two layabouts who are basically just poncing around town, mm-hmm. getting drunk and philosophising and being idiots.
I wanted to talk about, I guess, research would be the word. You've already mentioned how familiar you are with the city, but this book is full of fantastic passages of, great nights out and the sort of terrible, not morning, but day and half of the next day afterwards. Seems like, banknotes drying on the radiator and things. And so how well do you know
Are you
know
asking
that
me
world?
Whether I've taken drugs?
No, how familiar with those nights out?
Here we go. So, yeah, sure. There's a lot that I drew on from life and lots of kind of characters and scenes too, mm-hmm. that started out in my experience of reality and lots of things I stole from funny things my friends had said and just from crazy places. Manchester's great for this as well. You end up in some really weird places on mm-hmm. nights out, really random, strange things. And I just thought, literally it was so good you couldn't make it up. The truth was better than the fiction. So strange incidents that I did just kind of write up pretty much verbatim. But what I would say is that even those scenes have to do something within a novel. They're not just set pieces. They can't just be, I'm writing something that was 300 pages long, and so the overall story arc has to work, and to make that work, those set pieces have to have sense within the story. And even the characters that started out in life had to grow away from life in a way to work in the book. The only thing that I would say remains true, in inverted commas, obviously, but I would say that the emotions that I'm exploring, the worries of Laura and the things that they go through and the things that their friendship goes through, that's the truth. That's the thing of this book that comes directly from me onto the page. All those emotions, and then, that didn't really go through too much of a filter, even in terms of fiction.
And just one final thing for me then, and then I'd like you to read a bit of the book for us. I mentioned Zoe's book earlier, mm-hmm. and it's difficult to pin this on, that two books don't necessarily make a movement, but do you think there's more books out there now about women badly behaving in this sort of way?
I don't know. I mean, I was very grateful that the book it felt like it did kind of catch a wave of, the books about women behaving in ways that might normally not have made it through into attention, and I suppose, but more than that, not just about the behaving badly, but things like, I think Zoe said in an interview, things like women having an existential crisis, mm-hmm. which would normally be male territory, because whenever it's about, something's about a woman, it has to be related to a relationship, yes. or, something like that. And so I think just like the lonely points in Animals, where Laura is really going through dark nights of the soul and on her own, I do feel like that is something that I want to read more about women feeling completely alone, and how do you make sense of yourself as a woman and as a person if you have no biological purpose traditionally, as in you're not doing the baby thing, mm-hmm. and you've lost all society for one reason or another, and you have no sense of fulfillment in your work, and your friendship's threatened too. And so I was grateful that the book got caught that wave and was put alongside books like Zoe's. But I don't know. I mean, I think you look at there's been women writing fantastic books about behaving badly and female characters behaving badly throughout history. You can trace this sort of anti-heroine, if you like, way back. And I wouldn't want to not acknowledge those great writers, some of whom are my favourite.
Like what? What sort of thing? I mean, because I'm thinking...
Like Jean Rhys.
But they're not necessarily unapologetic in the same way.
You mean mine isn't apologetic?
Yes.
Or you mean theirs isn't apologetic?
Theirs isn't in the same way.
Oh, so you mean... Okay, well...
Perhaps that's the new thing, that this is like, unapologetic about it.
Yeah, yeah.
There doesn't have to be some sort of psychological thing behind somebody's behaviour. It's not like a function of...
Oh, okay, I get what you mean. So it's like there isn't a moral kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, and that is actually important. I did want to... I didn't want to write a cautionary tale. And I know what you mean there, actually. And in that, I didn't want to say that these women are going out lording it up and being hedonistic, therefore they should have to be punished, which is what, I guess, there is some punishment. There's some sense of punishment in the past, perhaps, which I didn't want there to be in this. So even at the... Well, I won't talk about the end of the book, but at the end of the book, there's no sense of punishment or kind of... Yeah, she doesn't go off and have a think and change her ways, because I didn't want to write that book, and I don't think that's realistic either.
And indeed, all the people that she knows from the past that have are presented very much in a cautionary way.
True. And I think that what bothers me about that is stasis, and I guess that book, the book is about a character who wants to change and grow and move like all living things, and so stasis is the antithesis of that. And so... any kind of, if you're an addict, it's very different. That's why I was very specific about these girls not being addicts. They're not. They use drugs and drink recreationally, but neither of them are addicts. And that was really important, because that in itself is obviously a static situation. You've got to get out of it. You can't be like that. So they're not at the mercy of those things. And so I think that I wanted to write about characters who were having a great time, and then even though they do punish themselves in a way, in that the hangovers are brutal, and they do sort of like have those really horrible 4 a.m. ground zero moments, despite all of that, that's not the problem for them. The drink and the drugs, it's not the real problem. The real problem is in the people that are around them and what that's the effect that that's having on their lives.
Okay, well, let's...
I'll just read from the beginning,
yes,
shall I?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a good start.
So, the first chapter is called White Piss Good, Amber Piss Bad.
Good rule to live by.
Thank you, yeah, it's one I try and live by. You know how it is. Saturday afternoon, you wake up and you can't move. I blinked, and the floaters on my eyeballs shifted to reveal Tyler in her ratty old kimono over in the doorway. Way I see it, she said, glass in one hand, lit cigarette in the other. Girls are tied to beds for two reasons, sex and exorcisms. So, which was it with you? I squinted up at my right arm, which felt like it was levitating, but no, nothing so glamorous. The plastic bangle on my right wrist had hooplaed over a bar on the bedhead during the night, manacling my hand and suspending my arm over the pillow. I wriggled upwards to release it, but only managed to travel an inch or so before a strange, elasticy feeling pulled me back. I looked down. My tights, or rather the left leg, I was still sluttishly sporting the right mid-thigh, had wrapped itself around a bed knob. I tugged. No good. The knot held fast. Get that for me, would you? I said. She'd moved across the room and was leaning against the wardrobe. Her wardrobe. Her room. We'd been out. Had we been out? A montage of images spooled through the brain fog. Fizzy wine, flat wine, city streets, cubicles, highly experimental burlesque moves on bar stools. Tyler took her time, looking for somewhere to put her cigarette. I knew she was really savouring the scene. This was one for the ever-burgeoning anecdote store, to be wheeled out, exaggerated and relished on future nights that would doubtlessly end in similar indignities. Hey, remember the time you tied yourself to the bed? Killer. Where did you sleep anyway? I said. Oh, I didn't sleep. I fonzed it on the back lawn with a spritzer and my shades on. Fonzing it was making yourself feel better about things, a.k.a. the inevitable existentials, by telling yourself that you were cool and everything was fine. We also referred to it as self-charming. It had a 55% success rate depending on location and weather. What time is it now? I asked. Tyler tugged at the knot, raised an eyebrow and threaded the tight leg into a straight black line, which she held taut to show me. 5:30. And what time did we get in? She pinged the tight leg at me and held up her hand. I thought she was saying 5, but no, she was saying no. No forensic autopsies. I nodded. The effects of the day's self-charming were stable but critical. Don't think about endings. Don't look down. There were rules that had to be obeyed in order to guarantee a horror-free hangover. No news. No parental phone calls. Some fresh air if you could tolerate the vertical plane. Sitcoms. Carbohydrates. I ran my swollen tongue over my unbrushed teeth. A farmish smell. Furriness. How do you feel? She asked. Like an entire family of raccoons is nesting in my head. Nesting raccoons? How nice for you. I've got 2 bull seals fucking a bag of steak. I sat up. Woof. Liquefying head rush. I looked down and caught sight of the prolapsed duvet on the floor by the side of the bed, its insides lolling between missing buttons of the striped cotton cover. I squinted at Tyler. 5'2" with cropped black hair sprung into curls. Face like a fallen putto. Deadly. She gripped her fag between her teeth as she opened her kimono and retied it tighter. She was wearing knickers but no bra, a bold move for the back garden in March. She pulled the fag from her teeth and exhaled. "I know this will only concuss you further," she said, "but I'm getting excited about the Olympics."
I've been talking to Emma Jane Unsworth, and we've been talking about her novel Animals. So, Emma, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thank you, Neil. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Lee Rourke. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
After 15 years writing strategy for advertising agencies, Alex Horston took a break to go back to university and her first love, books. She completed a Master's in English and started a PhD, but put it aside when the idea for her first novel surfaced. She's currently working on her second novel, but it's that first novel we're going to be talking about, which is In My House. So, Alex, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about it.
No problem, hello.
So, tell me what In My House is about. What's the story?
Well, it's the story of a character called Maggie. She's 57 years old when we meet her, and she lives in Queen's Park with her dog. And she lives a quiet sort of life. She keeps herself to herself. She has a couple of well-chosen friends who she walks with. But she even, you know, she keeps those people at arm's length. And we meet her when she is on her way home from a walking holiday in Mallorca. She travels, she passes through Gatwick. She's queuing for the passport control. She goes to the loo, and while she's waiting there, a young woman behind her mouths a single word, "help." Now, in that instance, Maggie chooses to help her. It transpires that this girl, Anya, has been trafficked, and Maggie's act frees her, basically. Now, Maggie returns home and intends to really tuck that away and just continue as she was, but that's not going to happen because Anya wants to get in touch. They meet, ostensibly so Annie can just thank her for this generous gesture, but a friendship begins to grow between them. And the book is really the story of this strange and unlikely friendship between these women. And also, across time, we begin to understand quite why Maggie lives such a sort of quiet and solitary life.
And there's also a bit of press interest as well. And again, this is now a world of Facebook and Twitter and what have you and social media, and this is something that Maggie's thrust into, which obviously goes against her instincts somewhat.
It is, yes. I mean, as we find out over the course of the novel, there are very good reasons why she wishes to remain private. But yeah, I was interested in the ways in which we can unwittingly find or start to occupy a public space quite against our choice or will, and what you can do, you know, the extent to which you can really avoid that in these days. So yes, Maggie is a character who is in no way comfortable with any of the intrusions of social media, but it's a way to sort of explode, another way to explode and explore the invasion of privacy.
So Maggie Benson, she's the narrator of the novel, a somewhat perhaps a reluctant narrator as well, even though the book's in the first person. And Anya, the girl that she rescues, I mean, potentially is a much more colourful character with a more exciting story, and yet you've chosen to write the book about Maggie, 57-year-old woman, which is probably a bit unusual these days. So was that a deliberate choice?
Well, it wasn't really. I mean, I knew nothing when I started about the marketplace and publishing and what was interesting or sellable or not, beyond what I, as a reader, became interested in. But the character of Maggie really struck me in a way that no other character or idea has done since. When I was listening, weirdly enough, to my mum and my brother-in-law have a disagreement, and my mum was saying, it was about the extent to which people can ever really change. And my mum felt that, yes, a person can change entirely dependent upon the circumstances and the situations they find themselves in. But my brother-in-law said, no, we have intrinsics and core values and things that are essential to us that really hold true pretty much whatever life throws at you. And as I was listening to that, I was just so interested. You know, I wasn't quite sure where I stood on this. And really, the character of Maggie came into my mind at that moment, who is... really, she wants to believe my mum's point. She wants to think that you can start again and there is a fresh page. But the conversation of the novel, really, is their argument. To what extent can you ever turn your back on the past, and what do we carry forward, and what are the intrinsics that we can never throw off? So, yeah, she was later down the line, I sort of thought, oh, goodness, are people going to like this character? She's a bit prickly, she's wry, she can be a bit sarcastic, but I personally really like her. I think
she's a great character.
I think she's funny. She keeps it hidden, you know, she's not... Everything isn't out there on a plate like so much contemporary culture is. But over time, you know, over the course of the novel, I think we begin to find out more about her.
And so Anya, who's... As I said, it's Maggie that narrates the story. Mm. So we see Anya, obviously, from Maggie's perspective. Mm. And therefore she's a bit elusive, but tell us something about who Anya is.
Well, Anya is 19. She's been trafficked, but the book is very much not about sex trafficking. And really, she came into my mind as somebody that would challenge this sort of carapace that Maggie's built around her. There are, I mean, I will let the reader decide as they go through the book, but there are echoes of Maggie's daughter. There are moments when they become very intimate, obviously not sexually intimate. And what Anya is a dispossessed, lonely, powerless young girl new in a city. Mm-hmm. And that is the reason why, you know, she is able to get, or she would even want to, get so close to Maggie. So, I mean, above all, I wanted her to be a teenager in a new place. I didn't want her just to be a victim. I didn't want her just to be, you know, this person that's had this terrible experience. So that was a hard job, actually, because I wanted to be true enough to her experience, but I didn't want her to be a typical victim.
And you say it's not strictly about sex trafficking, but you must have researched that world for background.
I did, yes. I had a brilliant person that helped me called Zoe Gardner at Asylum Aid, who tried to explain to me the vagaries of the system, which is totally impenetrable. There's no typical case. But I spoke with her in the process of writing the novel, and she read it an early draft and was able to help me get stuff factually correct. There are obviously many, many stories online about people to whom this has happened. I read, I hope, enough. But what I wanted to do was use that then as a sort of springboard, and then just try and invent or uncover the character of Anya alongside sort of what I knew. And I think that's certainly the line I tried to tread with research. You've got to know enough not to muck it up, but sort of wear that learning lightly, so that the sort of emotional truth of the person, and that individual comes through.
But the bureaucracy of the afterlife of Anya's experience is part of the book as well.
It is part of the book. I mean, Anya is very private as well. And as you say, this is a book in Maggie's voice. So Maggie, and therefore the reader, is only exposed to what Anya chooses to tell us. So again, this is there are parallels between these two women who are wanting to start again and not wanting to constantly revisit what went before. So yes, there's some that you will rub up against some of the process in the book.
I'm Kate Hamer. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Now, Anya becomes part of Maggie's life. Maggie becomes somewhat dependent on her, perhaps, as well, and they become very close. But she also becomes her help, I guess. Which, I mean, ironically, I mean, it's obviously nowhere near as bad, but, you know, considering that she's someone who was being trafficked into this country, we could perhaps, you know, sort of explore how she might be exploited by Maggie as well.
Yes, and I think that is one of the things. I mean, it's a very shaded and complex relationship between the two of them. And as I started writing it, I actually didn't know, I didn't have a sort of idea in my mind that I was trying to sort of communicate. So it unfolded on the page as the reader reads it. And it does evolve into some grey and slightly uncomfortable areas. And one of that, as you say, is the idea of payment. But also emotionally, Maggie asks the question, am I using Anya? You know, is she meeting a need that I have that is not about reciprocity. It's just about, you know, fulfilling something, a hole that I have in my own world. So yeah, the questions of dependency and manipulation and who is using who are kind of important in the book, I think.
I mentioned it's your debut novel, although it certainly doesn't read like a debut novel. And in fact, it wasn't strictly a debut novel.
I can explain why. No, very much. It was actually my first published novel. I do have another one, an earlier one, rotting hopefully in a bottom drawer, as I think many people do actually. The idea that these debut writers, this has sort of been come straight out in one magnificent draft. I think a lot of people have got years and years of work behind them. So yeah, my experience was that I, as you mentioned in the early part of the interview, I went back to university. I did an English degree, a master's, not in creative writing, in literature. And really the time, just having time, having headspace, I'd had a job in advertising and two young kids, but suddenly there was time, first time in, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And really, ideas started to surface and I began to write on the side, a bit of a guilty secret, didn't tell anyone. I think a lot of people have that experience as well, you know, they just don't want to quite come out as a wannabe writer or a writer. And yeah, my first novel, I think, was that novel that people talk about when you're talking. It was about advertising, funnily enough. Yeah. You're getting a lot of stuff, your own personal issues, and what you feel about your life off of your chest. But I did it. I completed it with the help of Gold Dust, which is a brilliant writer's mentoring scheme. And then I did what everybody does, started writing these terribly tricky letters to agents that you're agonising over, and your synopsis and your one-line elevator pitch. And it all went off. And really, I spent a year getting the odd bite, and you know, someone would phone back and like this but not that, and it was tantalising enough to sort of keep me in the game whilst absolutely destroyingly gut-wrenchingly awful, you know, a year on, when in the end I sort of thought, oh god, I'm gonna just, you know, I'm gonna have to bin this. But in the meantime, which I would advise to anybody in the same situation, I started writing something else, and that was this. And to be honest, as soon as I started, it was apparent this is better. So I'd learned stuff. I mean, it's hard, it's painful to put by, you know, a year or more work, but, you know, you learn.
But would this book have been this book if you hadn't have put in that?
Definitely not. Definitely not. It's a bit of a plonky metaphor, but I, you know, it's like when you do your first house, you just, you do it, and then you come back, and you go, I would never put loo there, the loo doesn't go there, you know. And there is really obvious sort of structural and, you know, craft learnings that you can do first time. I'm not, you know, that you just, you know not to do again, at least.
However, you are now a published novelist with a book that's out under your belt. I mean, might that change people's perspectives on the other one, or at least...
Well, it's interesting, yeah, maybe, I don't know.
Could it be, you know, reworked? Have you got, I mean, is there a novel in the advertising world that's going to come out at some point?
Well, Mad Men has been since, and maybe, I don't know if I can do as good a job as that. I don't know. I think it's in the right place, to be honest, in the bottom drawer.
And I said that you're working on a second novel, which I presume there's not a great deal we can say about it, but tell us something.
I will. It's another female protagonist. She's younger, she is in her 40s, and she's in the middle of family life. So she's got three kids, her parents live by, set in London again. And this time, it is about a missing person. Basically, she has a feckless and very adored brother. She throws him a 40th birthday party, and the next day, he's gone. He's done a bunk. He hasn't left a note, but he's gone. And really, that act throws a grenade into her family life, and we begin again. Secrets, lies, passion. So yeah, I think there's going to be some tonal similarities, but my concerns are the same. Difficulty of other people, how we can live with others and, you know, be ourselves. But yeah, it's a new cast, and hopefully people will like it.
And when can we expect to see that?
Oh goodness, I don't know. I don't know. I'm about three quarters way through a first draft, so I'll get it to my agent and my editor. I don't mind showing early work.
But this is, it's the second book of a two-book deal with Faber.
Yes, exactly. So I'm working
so it is cool.
People.
We will see it.
Oh, we will see. Well, let's hope so. I don't like it. I don't like it. That remains to be seen. But yes, we should see it. I hope, well, to be the paperback of this. So maybe next year or a little after that.
I'm going to get you to read a bit of the book, Alex. But before we do, I'll just ask one more question. And then we'll finish off with a bit of the book. It's been out for about a month, so how is it going? What's the reaction been?
It's been fine. It's been good. I've had some good reviews from the broadsheet, which is brilliant, you know, because you don't always necessarily expect that. So largely, in the industry, it's been good. And the bloggers have been great. You know, I've had some really interesting reviews, actually, from bloggers who put a lot of time in. And, you know, people write an essay on your work, and you don't find that anywhere else. So I've been really, really delighted and actually really surprised, you know, in some of the things that people find, and I has made me think differently about my work. I mean, Goodreads and Amazon is not always easy. Not everybody likes it, so there are, I'm not going to lie, you know, you get people that don't, and that's hard. It's hard to read, but it's part of the process. And I'm trying to begin with, I was veering manically between elation and kind of high drama whenever someone said something good or bad. But I think that I'm trying now to walk a rather more even sort of path through the middle and take it on the chin and not get too hyped if it's good and not to get too distraught if it isn't. Because I think it's the only way to get through this unscathed.
Okay, well let's hear a bit of In My House then.
Okay. This is from the beginning. As I mentioned, the action starts when Maggie arrives at Gatwick. So she's just got off a plane now and she should be heading for passport control. I headed for the ladies. The sight of my face in a public lavatory mirror is always a surprise, something I put down to the lighting, but a distraction nonetheless. There was a moment or two spent glancing at myself in each new panel as the line moved forwards. I watched the other women look at themselves, pull special faces for their own reflections. Their lack of self-conscious startled me, their absorption in the task. They couldn't all have someone meeting them off their planes. Some surely would merely return to whoever it was they'd left outside, an everyday person, holding their spot. I felt my own dislocation from that and was fine with it. Then my attention was free, and almost instantly I had a sense of the person behind me. It was her breathing, short, hard and pulsed. She was panting almost, giving off an animal panic that I felt in an answering surge of adrenaline. My first thought was some kind of anxiety attack, and then that she'd done something bad, left a bomb. I looked back to the mirror and found her there. It was clear that she meant to tell me something. Her face was locked, its lack of response in breach of every protocol of civility. It was like standing in front of a painting, knowing that there's meaning, hidden but suggested if only you knew the language of the thing. A few seconds of this blank exchange, and she turned, the girl, twisted her upper body round, deliberate eyes on me till the last, and whispered close and brief behind her. The woman she spoke to gave a flick of a nod. The girl left the line and walked past me, close enough that I smelt new sweat. She went to a sink, bent deep at the waist and looked up at her face. She viewed herself differently from the previous women, up close and frank, something brutal in it. She filled cupped hands with cold water and threw it at herself, darkening the roots of her hair. Behind me, the older woman watched. The two were dressed the same, clothes near enough to typical if you squinted. Blue jeans, bright tops with zips and hoods. But look again and you could spot the differences. Colour and cut slightly off. I surprised myself with that acknowledgement. No branding or logos. Cheap. Not high street cheap. Cheaper than that. There was a similarity in their colouring. A thin, milky paleness of skin. A shared ethnicity, perhaps. The hair was dyed a similar red. Family, even. Surely not friends. Behind me, the woman's phone pinged and the girl's eyes were back to mine. In that second, they flared and I saw her fear, unmistakable. The keys of the woman's mobile clicked and she hissed as she typed. The noise of air sucked hard through her teeth. She was still tapping when the phone rang in her hand and she answered in a language I didn't recognise. In the mirror, the girl mouthed, "Help."
I've been talking to Alex Horston. We've been talking about her novel In My House, which is out now from Faber and Faber. So, Alex, thank you very much for telling me about it.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm Tom Barbash, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So I'm talking to the writer Naomi Alderman again. And Naomi, what have you chosen to talk about this time?
Well, I have just finished reading this really fantastic book by Tim Parks, Teach Us to Sit Still, A Skeptic's Search for Health and Healing is the subtitle. And I had heard about this from multiple sources over the years, and people had talked about how good it was. And you know how it is, you kind of hear about a book until there's a sort of tipping point and you suddenly go and get it. And I have devoured it in 2 or 3 days, even though I wanted to spend longer on it because it was just so good. And it's about, it's memoir really, it's about Tim Parks in his 50s starts to suffer with bladder pain, pelvic pain, and he thinks it's his prostate, and he goes to see various doctors and consultants, and they do scans and they say, actually, your prostate's looking fine, we can go in and do the surgery anyway, which often gives people relief. And at the point that he's sort of about to embark on some probably unnecessary surgery, he comes across, he's really at the end of his tether, as one can be with physical pain and with chronic conditions, it's just debilitating. He comes across a book on the internet, which just, the title of it strikes him, it's called A Headache in the Pelvis, which is about this idea that the pains and the physical problems that we suffer aren't just about the body, they're also to do with the mind, which is something that I'm very interested in. We have this rather odd idea, I mean, it's really a religious idea, actually, that the mind and the body are completely separate and the body is somehow less good than the mind. You know, the mind is what will survive of us when we go to heaven, whereas the body is of the earth and will return to the dust. It's peculiar. I mean, I suppose it's an idea about eternal life, and we know that bodies decay, so the only bit of us that could possibly get eternal life is some kind of mind, but... So Tim Parks embarks on a journey of meditation and awareness. And in the end, oh, I mean, I can't really spoil this book. You can't spoil it. The journey is what it's about, not about the end, which in fact is the same with meditation. In the end, he comes to a place where he's able to say that those pains he feels somehow were good in that they led him to something really interesting and wonderful. I also really liked, even though everybody else liked it, which makes one feel bad about liking it, I really liked the meditation section in the middle of Eat, Pray, Love. The eating part, the Italian eating, fine. The falling in love at the end, fine. What I found really astonishing in that book was the meditative journey, the journey towards integration and acceptance. And this book really gave me some more of that. And I just wanted to kind of pick out a couple of bits. One is from right at the beginning, where Tim Parks is talking about his father, who was a preacher. And I think often people who have come from a super religious background, as indeed I have, to extricate yourself from that, you have to do away with all sort of superstition. You have to say, oh, it's all nonsense. And then at a certain point, you have to accept that it's not, or like it's quite hard to, but it's good to accept that maybe there's more to the numinous than just whatever religion it was you were trying to escape from. So right at the start, he's talking about his own writing, and he says about his father, my father read the Bible and wrote his sermons. He told you what was true and how you must behave. Rhythmically, persuasively, the way politicians do, and the pundits of opinion columns. The people who know everything and are sure of themselves. My novels have tended the other way, suggested how mysterious it all is, how partial anyone's view, how comically lost we all are. But even this is preaching of a kind. The fact is, as soon as you start with words, you're locked into a debate, forced to take a position with respect to others, confirming or rebutting what has been said before. Nothing you say stands alone or is complete in the present. It has its roots in the past and pushes feelers into the future. And as we grow heated, marking out our corner, staking our claim, we stop noticing the breath on the lips, the tension in our fingers, the pressure of the ground under our toes, the tick of time in the blood. Oh, it's so good. Now, he is a really good writer, first of all, a really good writer. And it's really, it's part of the concern of the book. It's something that really speaks to me, which is about how words influence the way that you think about the world and the way you experience the world. And that idea that words trap you in opinions, and somehow opinions are always wrong, right? Whatever your opinion is, there's always some kind of counter to it.
You've said that you love this book, and there are many reasons to love it, one of which may be the fact that you're also a writer. So I want to talk about how that resonance is there for, is there something more to this book for somebody who is a writer?
I mean, I think it's something there for you if you're, there's definitely something there if you're a writer, there's probably something there if you're a reader, you know. So if you're the kind of person who's interested in books and the way that books are put together and the confusions that are in the mind of a writer when they're putting them together, I think this book will have a lot for you. I wanted to do another bit from the end because he starts off right at the beginning. He's talking about his father and sermonizing and his own novels and opinions. And then right at the end, he has set an examination to his students in translation, set them to translate a piece of Christopher Hitchens, obviously a man with a lot of opinions. And he talks about Hitchens' prose. He says, "The prose invites a fight. The words are jumping up and down, making rude gestures and waving fists." Perhaps this is the problem with so many invitations to get involved in the world. They are inviting you to join in a fight without it being important what you're fighting about. I thought, oh, that is exactly Twitter, isn't it? That is exactly Facebook and its comments on the internet and its newspaper articles. And what he's talking about is the way that that affects our bodies, actually, that our bodies aren't separate to us. We hold all of this anger that's somehow fermented by this very verbal culture we live in, we hold it in our body. And so the book is about sitting still and being quiet and how little room for that there is in the world.
But all of that is, that's the meat of being a writer, words, and having a head full of words. So is emptying your head of things, of words, a dangerous thing for a writer?
Actually, I mean, that is something that he really gets into. So at one point on one of his meditation retreats, he decides that he should no longer be a writer. But then when the retreat is over, he finds that what he wants to do is write. So he has a very interesting conversation with the sort of guru who's leading this retreat. And he said, "Oh, I think I should be a monk. I think I should, you know, stop writing." And the guru says to him, "Yes, many people seem to feel that they should be a monk. But," he says, "I also wrote a book. And, you know, it's not the best book, but books can be a useful way of describing things, expressing things. So I think what it's calling for is not to say, give up everything, sit in silence all the time. Engage with the world. Why the hell not? But don't think that it's the be all and end all. Somehow, if words are at the very centre of your life, you're probably missing out on silence. Just like if, I don't know, if food is at the very centre of your life, you're probably missing out on, I don't know, some other thing. If sport is the centre of your life, you're missing out on something, you know? Like, whatever it is that you're resisting, let it.
What about more prosaically? I mean, being a writer sat at a desk all day. I mean, I know even not writing, but just having an office job. I'm myself subject to various, the later in the day it gets, subject to various little niggles and annoyances and unidentifiable pain. You know, does it reflect that in your own life on this book?
Oh, God, yes, definitely. I mean, you know, all writers get back pain. I've actually been, like, doing lots of exercises to try to prevent that. I think also, there's something about, like, the actual writing is not so much the problem for me. It's the sitting at my desk when I'm not writing, either fiddling about on the internet or just kind of staring blankly into space trying to work things out. And then you end up, like, hunched forward. And God knows, one of the first things Margaret Atwood ever said to me when we started talking was, "You must do back exercises because pain is very distracting." So I think probably a call for all of us to re-engage more with our bodies and stop thinking that we can be little brains on stalks is a wonderful call. I've just bought myself one of those little scooters, you know, not a Vespa, one of those ones that you push along with your foot. Because it was just so enjoyable. I had a go with the friends and it was just so enjoyable. I thought, yes, why not enjoy my body as well as my brain?
So we're going to be able to see you scooting around the streets like one of those Shoreditch people.
I hope so. Yeah. It's basically that I'm just a total hipster. and meditation just goes along with that. It'll soon be making my own spelt bread.
So what happens to Tim Parks in the end then? How does the, as I said, it's the journey rather than the actual conclusion. So we can sort of give it away. How does he end up?
He gets to a brilliant conclusion. His pain is gone by the end and not having had to have surgery. He's managed to get rid of his pain by, or at least make it completely possible. So the pain is much reduced, and when it comes, he knows what to do. By the end, by doing Vipassana meditation and sitting for hours at a time, sometimes doing 10-day retreats to do for his meditation. And yeah, he gets to a brilliant, brilliant place. It's kind of wonderful. It really inspired me to go and do more meditation. Maybe in the end, I'll go and do a Vipassana retreat. So listen, this is a thing that he says about, because for ages he had been saying that he felt that he wanted to stand up straight. The whole way through, like, his spine has kind of got a weird curvature, which is causing him pain. And he says this. This is towards the end of the book. No longer much interested in standing up straight, I found my back pulling upright by itself. It happened over the spring. Taking my familiar run across the hills, I was surprised to find myself aware of the muscles at the base of the spine. How odd. Days later, I could feel my shoulders. A slight warm presence. Finally, my neck. It was as if skeletal spaces had been very lightly penciled in. Becoming aware of the muscles turned out to be one with straightening them, or letting them straighten me. I didn't do anything. I just had to pay attention. The only difficult thing was getting used to seeing the world from a different angle. It's so like psychotherapy. It's exactly kind of magnetically aligned with it, which is to say the thing to do is just to bring something into awareness. And once it's in awareness, you don't have to do anything else. Like once you go, oh, I'm behaving with my boss the same way that I always behave with my dad. Like that's it. You don't have to then go, oh God, now I need to really work on it. Once you've noticed it, once you've brought it into awareness, it will start to sort itself out. It's a miracle. So yeah, I love that stuff. I'm in a real phase at the moment, actually, of reading a lot of psychotherapy memoirs and sort of memoirs of people's like internal journeys. So goodness knows what that means. Either I'll be going on an internal journey or I'll be writing a novel about one.
We'll look forward to that then. So I've been talking to Naomi Alderman and we've been talking about Teach to Sit Still by Tim Park. So Naomi, thank you very much for sharing it with us.
It's been a delight. I can highly recommend this book to everybody.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.